History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to take a couple of very simple steps. If we take the initiative to ask a few questions and then employ enough patience to listen, we might just be amazed by some of the long buried memories that start to emerge once again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I expect that to be the case again today in New Canaan, Connecticut, a town of a little more than 20,000 people, famous for the architecture of some of its mansions and the who's who of residents that counts famous entertainers, politicians, sports figures, and journalists, among others. But I don't think there's anybody in New Canaan I'd rather sit down for an hour with than 96-year-old Frank Gallo. And by the time we're done today, maybe you're going to feel the same way. Frank served in the 78th Infantry Division during World War II. But as always, we're going to start out a little earlier on with his childhood in Stamford, Connecticut, about 10 miles from where he lives now.
At that time, with the Depression, and our family didn't have any money at all. My father, during the war, got a job at Luders Marine in Stamford, making 20 bucks a week. I went to high school with a trade school course and went to trade school. But when I became 16, I had to quit to go to work for help the family. So I was taking up printing. I went to Condé Nast, making $18 a week for 37 and a half hours. Gave my mother $10 and I kept $8. And that's how it was. And then when I became 18, in February, I was drafted in April and combat in December, 44.
Just like that. And I want to ask you a little more about that, just because this is so foreign to so many people now. I mean, a lot of kids grow up with a smartphone in their hand. I would love to hear what your childhood was like. You mentioned the Depression and that your family didn't have a lot. Were you aware of that, or was that kind of out of sight, out of mind?
I was aware of it because we had to do things to save money because you didn't have any. Used to go down to the coal yard there where the railroad ties were thrown, and my father and I would pick up railroad ties, take them home, saw them, and use them in the furnace. But that's all you could do. You know, empty the ashes out of the furnace, throw them, your driveway was ashes, and that's it. Went to school. You just got along with kids in the neighborhood, playing tag or whatever, and nothing that should cost any money because you didn't have it.
How about food? Did you always have enough to eat?
Yeah, but it would be like lentils or pasta or something like that. If you make 20 bucks a week and go to a grocery store, what are you going to buy? You know, all right, things were a lot cheaper, but I don't know how they did it with five kids.
Yeah, and you were the second of those five kids. How'd you get along with all your siblings?
Oh, good. Yeah, we did good. Older sister took up tap dancing, and so did I. We used to practice in the house and do dances at the schools and different restaurants. My mother played the piano, so kept busy that way. But it was fun. Of course, at the time, you don't realize what you're going through because that's all you know. You don't know that there's other things out there, so you got along. Fixed bicycles for 10 cents a piece or something just to pick up a dime because the dime at that time was a lot of money.
You mentioned the tap dancing. Is that something you continued later in life?
No, I went in the service and got out, no.
Well, and in those childhood years, I know that's a long time ago we're talking about, but do you remember ever having kind of a dream, an ambition, that thought of, hey, when I grow up, this is who I want to be or what I want to do?
Not really, no, because at the time we just didn't know. Did a lot of ice skating during the winters there, and when we were young, and that I kept up. Even after the war was over, I sent my mother a letter, sent me my ice skates, because we went to Berlin for occupation. I got a job in the kitchen your time off was your own. So I was skating in Berlin. Back to my 90th birthday, I had an ice skating party in Darien.
And you laced him up?
Yep, and I skated.
Well, everyone's wondering, well, did he stay up? Did he stay on his skates, or did he go down?
No, I was up. I haven't fell on skates in years. I would have done it on my 95th birthday, but my daughter would have had a fit.
Well, I guess I'll ask the question now. I mean, it's not too long till you hit the century mark. You think 100 would be worthy of lacing him up one more time?
I don't know if I can. I still have the skates. I got them since I was 14 years old. Uh-huh. They're racers.
And is that something you skated, or did you try hockey too? Or
no, just racing. Yeah.
And I may ask a question that's irrelevant or doesn't make a lot of sense. And back then, even if you're close to something, you're pretty far away. But right now, this part of the country is pretty excited about something going on in the Bronx with a baseball player. And I'm wondering if way back then, were you paying attention to the Yankees and baseball and all that?
I've been going for the Yankees since 1936. I remember when Phil Rizzuto first came up, and I've been a Yankee fan ever since.
Did you ever get to go into the city to Yankee Stadium as a boy?
Oh, yeah. But then it was like 75 cents. Now you can't even, the beer is what, $8?
Yeah. Exactly, that's good. Did you have a Yankee who was your favorite, the guy that you enjoyed watching or rooting for the most?
Joe DiMaggio.
I had a feeling you'd say that. For people who never got to see him in person or live through that era, what was it that was so magical about him?
Well, he was a perfect gentleman. You never heard anything bad about him. And when he played to the fullest of his ability. He's not one of these guys that hit the ball, if it's going to be caught, just trot down to first. He ran. And he often said, when asked why he plays so hard, he says, I do that because there may be fans in the stadium that have never seen him play. And that's how he was a good person.
I guess I have to ask you, since you're still following him, and you have been since 1936, what do you think of that guy in pinstripes now wearing number 99?
I think he's great. I'm glad he got to 61. He was under a lot of pressure, and he's a good person, and he's doing it without any steroids.
And so many of the Yankees from that era would end up like you in the service in the war. I mean, Yogi Berra is one of them who was over there. Can you compare what baseball and the Yankees meant back then to the way it is now? Do you see a difference?
Well, there was a difference because you were more in tune with the leagues. There was only two leagues then. We used to know every player in both leagues, their batting averages. But today, you don't even know the players. Put a game on, it's a team you've been going for. You have to look it up, see who these guys are.
Because it changes so frequently?
Yeah.
So you mentioned that when you were 16, you had to drop out of school to work so you could help feed your family with the five kids. Everyone's hearing that in the context of 2022, and some teenager might say, well, I don't want to do that. How did you feel about that then?
Well, I didn't mind. I mean, something that had to be done. You wanted to finish school, but I never finished high school. I did 2010. I graduated here. When the principal heard that I never graduated, he was well into the veterans, so he got a called state. Then he called me and said, well, be at the gym June something. We have a cap and gown for you.
What did that mean to you all those years later to have them do that for you?
Well, I thought it was great because the ceremony was great. We led the whole parade of all the graduates going out to the football field, and it was great.
You know, and usually I ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, and we can talk about that too. But being out here on the East Coast, it seems like there was more of an awareness of the war before America was in the war, with ships being sunk just off the coast and all that. What was your awareness of what was happening in the world?
Well, when that happened, I was only 15. I figured, well, the war's going to be over before I'm 18. But evidently it wasn't. And with war, there are no winners. One country may lose less than the other, but nobody wins. And it's hard for a lot of people to understand that.
Well, I'm glad you put it that way. So you said, you know, you figured the war would be over before You became a part of it. Did you notice things changing around Stanford, though, after that? Did you notice anything different?
Well, yeah. More people were being drafted and then volunteering to get in. And there was less men around and boys. And the factories were starting to get busy and doing things for the war effort instead of making razors or Yellowtown making locks, and things were going towards the war effort.
And did you think about, were you thinking about joining the service before they drafted you, or were you just busy doing what you were doing?
No, I never thought of joining, just working away. And when they drafted me, I had to go. We didn't have a choice. All they wanted was infantrymen then. I'm glad I wasn't any older, otherwise I'd been D-Day. I was in basic when D-Day happened.
You were in basic training when D-Day happened. And I'm always fascinated by those kind of stories because it hits everyone different and everyone's got a little different background. What was it like once you were drafted and you got into the Army? Were there some moments that kind of felt like, hey, you're in the Army now? This is what it's really going to be like?
Yeah, well, you never knew what it was going to be. But all I did was follow the orders. Whatever they told us to do, that's what I did. But I don't know if that was smart or not. I never... shirked away from anything. In fact, following orders. And one day in combat, my buddy and I were up on a hill firing at the Germans. We had a 60-millimeter mortar, and they had on another hill firing at us. But they were getting much closer to us because they had better weapons. So it got to be that they were so close. My buddy Charlie, he took off and left me up there alone. And me, I'm still staying there. And then finally the sergeant said, Gallo, get the hell out of there. But that's what I did. I followed orders and probably wasn't the smartest thing to do.
But you're still here, so you must have done something right. And I want to hear more about your experience with the mortar and in combat and all that. But I'm just wondering what it was like to say goodbye to your family and head overseas. And you gave us a feel for the timeline, how quickly this progressed.
Well, it was sad to go, but as I say, we didn't have a choice. You don't want to leave the family, and they certainly didn't want me to go. But even my mother, from what I understand, when she got the letter, of course, it was telling the Bronze Star, but she got a letter from the War Department. My younger sister said she wouldn't open it because she figured it was some wounded or dead or something. So my sister, when she came home from school, said, "No, you have to open it." And she opened it finally, and it was because of the Bronze Star.
And we're going to hear the story behind that Bronze Star, but that illustrates what a lot of parents went through during World War II, wondering if their boys would come home. And here's another question for you. Had you ever in your life been on a ship before when they sent you overseas?
No.
So what was that like?
We were sick most of the time because we went over in a convoy. It took 14 days to get to England. It was rough seas. Of course, they had going back and forth with the convoy. It shouldn't take that long, but 14 days.
They were zigzagging to avoid submarines?
Yeah.
Well, and I know this is a long time ago, and it might not be easy to remember this, but I'm always interested to know what your mindset was. I mean, some guys say they weren't worried. They knew they were going to come home no matter what. Other guys were scared out of their minds. Other guys were too sick to think about it because, the ocean. What do you think your mindset or your outlook was then?
Well, I thought that I would be coming home, but you didn't know what you're getting into. I mean, you're going overseas, but you never had that experience, so you really didn't know what was going on. You just assumed that you go in there and the war would be over and you go home, not knowing.
And had you already been assigned to the 78th Division when you went over, or did that happen? You were, okay. So you were going over with guys that you would end up serving with?
Yeah, but during combat, I never thought I'd get back home.
Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that, and I want to hear more about it. Where did they bring you ashore, and where'd you go from there?
Well, when we went to England, we ended up in Bournemouth, which is the Miami Beach of England, but I couldn't tell with all barbed wire on the shore and all. So after that, when we went to across the channel, we ended in France, but that was after D-Day. So we ended up going to France and to Belgium. Our first day in combat was in the Hurricane Forest, which was December 13th. And that was the coldest winter they ever had. Guys were getting frostbite right away the first day. Then the bulge started at just about then. So we ended up in part of the bulge. But the Germans didn't want to fight any more than we did. I used to see dead Germans, but I never said, another dead kraut. I would think a letter going home to that man's wife, mother, sister, or somebody. The same as any of our guys did.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old Frank Gallo of New Canaan, Connecticut, including his memories of his 19th birthday when he says he wasn't sure if he would live to see 20. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, you'll find photos and a little video of Frank inside the home that he and his late wife Viola built way back in 1954. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.